Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
There was a pretty good size, plate size, dinner platter size hole in that float.
Investigators say 2 float planes that crashed this month, leaving both pilots dead, had holes in their floats. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, October 21st. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, why some voters think the way Alaska selects judges should change.
All it does really is just move the politics behind closed doors.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Federal investigators say they found holes in the floats of 2 small planes that crashed on Alaska waterways in the past month, leaving both of their pilots dead. The National Transportation Safety Board released preliminary reports on the crashes yesterday. The first crash happened on September 25th. The NTSB report says Janelle Rude planned to fly from Whiskey Lake near Squintna to Lake Hood in Anchorage, but she never arrived. A rescue team later recovered her body from the Cessna 180 submerged at Whiskey Lake. The NTSB's Alaska Chief Clint Johnson says investigators found 7 holes in the Cessna's floats, including a large one that had been patched twice.
There was a pretty good size, plate size, dinner platter size hole in that float, and the floats were in pretty tough shape as far as corrosion and pitting.
The second crash occurred October 5th at the Chena Marina airstrip near Fairbanks, killing pilot and wilderness guide Gerald Stancil. NTSB investigators say Stancil was seen loading a generator and numerous pieces of gear into his Cessna 185 before making an aborted takeoff run. A witness said, quote, the floats were almost completely submerged, end quote, before the plane taxied for another attempt, then suddenly flipped over. Witnesses tried to save Stancil, but shifting cargo pinned him in the plane underwater. NTSB investigators later found 2 holes on the front of each of the plane's floats. Johnson says they appear to be left over from a replaced set of bumpers to soften impacts against docks.
The airplane was loaded to the point where those holes were submerged, and we're theorizing at this point right now that that's probably how the water got into the forward compartments of the floats.
Both Stancil and Rude were the only people aboard their planes. Johnson says the fact that both planes had holes in their floats has caught investigators' attention.
You know, that's our job, is to look at how accidents took place, find out the circumstances and the sequence of events, and then make recommendations to keep it from happening again. Will there be a recommendation to come out of this? Can't tell you at this point right now, but we do want to at least get the word out.
Both crashes remain under investigation. Many Alaskans in favor of holding a constitutional convention are hoping to change the way the state appoints judges. Alaska is one of 26 states that select judges in a way that's intended to keep politics out of the process. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George reports on how we ended up with the current system and why some people want something different.
When the framers of Alaska's constitution were debating how the state should pick its judges, the goal was to remove politics from the process as much as possible.
There had been some problems in the territorial days because they were basically political appointees by the president of the United States.
That's Matt Peterson, an Anchorage attorney who's currently teaching a seminar on the Alaska Constitution.
There was a wide variety of competence amongst the political appointees, and the idea was to have a system of what we would call merit selection, where people were decided on the basis of competence, integrity, fairness, that type of thing, and not on political considerations.
But Jim Minery says the system we ended up with missed the mark. He's executive director of Alaska Family Council, a conservative Christian advocacy group.
All it does really is just move the politics behind closed doors.
Minery is backing efforts to pass Ballot Measure 1, which would set another constitutional convention in motion. A chance to rewrite the judicial selection process is one of the main reasons he's pushing for a convention. Under the current system, an independent commission called the Alaska Judicial Council vets applicants and selects a pool of potential judges that are presented to the governor, who picks one to fill a judicial vacancy. The council is made up of three attorneys and three members of the public. The Chief Justice of the Alaska Supreme Court serves as chair of the council and can provide a tie-breaking vote. Minery and other opponents of the current process claim that the attorney members of the council skew liberal and have propagated a judiciary that leans to the left.
This is not about the council just saying, okay, these are the qualified people, we'll give you the governor. No, they do a very strong vetting process. And if they do not match the liberal members of the attorney side of the judicial council, the governor's not going to see those people.
Minery says he'd prefer to see a process that skips the council and allows the governor to appoint their pick, similar to the process for appointing U.S. Supreme Court judges. According to minutes from the original convention, delegates did consider this appointment method. They also considered the possibility of electing judges. Both were ruled out on the basis that they would subject judicial candidates to partisan politics. Even proponents of the Judicial Council say the current process isn't perfect.
No, I think people would be naive to say there's no politics in it.
Elaine Andrews is a retired Alaska Superior and District Court judge.
The governor can choose an applicant that the governor feels most comfortable with politically, but the citizens of Alaska can be assured that the governor's choice is someone who is qualified for the position, and not only qualified, but among the most qualified of the applicants.
Andrews rejects the notion that the council skews liberal in its decision-making. The majority of Alaska Bar Association members are nonpartisan or undeclared, according to a study that Alaska Family Council paid for in 2020. Republican former state senator John Coghill, whose father was an original delegate to the convention in 1955, says the Judicial Council is a noble idea for selecting judges, but he agrees with Minery and other conservatives who want to see their ideas better represented in the process.
On judicial selection, generally speaking, they have my heart on the matter, but do I think that they can change that in the political dynamic that we're in Alaska? I just don't think so.
He says adding more non-attorney layman seats to the council could be one way to address that concern, but he says it's not worth an entire constitutional convention. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
A group of Indigenous women were recognized for their military service during opening ceremonies at this year's Alaska Federation of Natives Convention in Anchorage. Reporter Emily Schwing has more.
For more than a decade, Alaska Native veteran Benno Cleveland has led a color guard procession at the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention. But this year, he did something a little different.
And if you notice that when we marched in, we had our women veterans up front. I want to thank our women veterans that came out to help us post colors today, because when they talk about our Native veterans, most people, they think about the men.
Following the presentation of colors, five Alaska Native and American Indian women were met with a standing ovation as they exited the convention hall. Juanita Mullen is from the Seneca Nation in New York State. She just retired as the American Indian and Alaska Native Veterans Liaison for the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
For the female veterans, actually putting him first in line was the first time I've ever seen them do this.
According to a 2020 report from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, only 11% of American Indian and Alaska Native veterans are women. Emily Downey is from Ambler. She says she was one of the first women to join the Alaska National Guard back in 1976.
It was a big step for me because I didn't know what I was stepping into. They just started letting females in the battalion in the Navy when I joined.
That's Flossie Davenport. She grew up in Nome. She served as a CB in the Navy from 1998 to 2003. She said she never thought about being a woman in service until she started to notice some of her superiors treated her differently.
Y'all had a bunch of salty dogs around me, and they were always like, oh, let me lift that. Oh, let me do that. So, but it was a great honor to be honored and recognized here today, because I think a lot of times we just kind of get lost in the rotation of things.
Benno Cleveland says women's military service in Alaska goes back to the Territorial Guard.
We also had women helping building camps, stations, bases here in Alaska. So, you know, we have to hold our women in high esteem. After all, they are the birth of the nation.
Cleveland says he asked all of the veterans who came to present colors at AFN if they'd be willing to honor the women. He says none of the men were opposed to supporting the women who have served alongside them. In Anchorage, I'm Emily Schwing.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a $500,000 grant will help restore the bus from Into the Wild.
Freeze it and document it in its current state because, you know, the most famous part of it is from 1992 when Chris McCandless was there.
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
In Alaska, it's illegal to be sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. But one woman whose husband is incarcerated in Kenai says long sentences like his can act as virtual life sentences when the chances of exiting the system are so slim. And she's pushing legislation to give juvenile offenders an earlier chance at freedom. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has more.
Brian Hall is part of a group of several men that grew up in Alaska's correctional system together and refer to each other as family. Brian, now 46, is serving a portion of his 159-year sentence at Wildwood Correctional Complex in Kenai. He's been incarcerated since he was 17 on charges of killing two people. And his earliest chance at parole is still decades away. His wife, Angela Hall, is leading the charge on legislation that would make sure Alaskans like him have an earlier chance at freedom.
My interest in the second look legislation started when I met my husband, my now husband.
Statewide, there are 30 people currently incarcerated who were convicted of their crimes as juveniles, according to a spokesperson with the Alaska Department of Corrections. Senate Bill 114 was introduced last year and would give those committed as kids a chance at discretionary parole review after their first 15 years serving. The bill wouldn't guarantee parole for those people, but it would give them a chance in front of the Alaska Parole Board. And if rejected, they could come back to the board after 2 years.
This way, they could develop a relationship with the parole board. The parole board could give recommendations of what they would like to see, and they could do these things in the meantime, and then hopefully be parole ready the next time they came up before the board.
Alaska is one of 25 states that doesn't allow life sentences without paroles for juveniles. But Angela says long periods of jail time, like the one her husband is serving, are virtual life sentences.
A virtual life sentence is basically a life sentence because it's anyone who's been sentenced to 50 plus years, which means you're being sentenced to death by incarceration.
She says the first chance Brian has to see the parole board will be when he's in his 70s.
The life expectancy for individuals who are incarcerated is much lower than that.
And that's just when he would be eligible. In 2020, the Alaska Parole Board accepted just 16% of the applications it received for parole. Megan Edge is a spokesperson with the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska. She says the state's prison population is an aging one, in part because fewer people are being granted discretionary parole today. And she's concerned about the higher-than-usual number of deaths in corrections custody this year. Edge says some of the 15 people who died in custody in 2020 were serving lengthy sentences.
So it's incredibly sad, especially in a state that doesn't have the death penalty. We're still committing people to death by incarceration.
She says young people often have a better shot at rehabilitation than people who were incarcerated when they were older. Angela says her husband, Brian, has turned his life around since he was first sentenced 3 decades ago. The two got married and celebrated their 10th anniversary this year. Brian got his GED and became a dog obedience instructor. He's Cherokee and keeps his spiritual and cultural practice alive as much as he can from Wildwood.
You hear about people getting sentenced all the time, but you don't really hear about, you know, what has happened to those people after 20 plus years, you know?
Angela says she doesn't know what's next for the legislation. Democrat Minority Leader Senator Tom Begich was the bill's sponsor last session. But the legislation didn't get a hearing, and Begich isn't running for another term.
We're not sure if there's going to be, you know, support for it at this point. So it just really depends on what happens with the elections.
Edge, with the ACLU, says the bill fits squarely into the broader prison reform work she's spearheading as part of the organization's new Alaska Prison Project. That initiative formed last month with the goal of reducing the number of incarcerated Alaskans and improving conditions for those who are already in the system. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
The state is calling its first sale of potential farmland west of Nenana a success. The Department of Natural Resources auctioned more than 2,000 acres in the Nenana-Tochacket Agricultural Project and is planning a second sale. But some area residents say the state is moving too quickly to develop the ag project. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
State Department of Natural Resources officials opened sealed bids Wednesday for the ag project parcels up for auction, and they say they sold about 90% of the land offered.
We typically sell 50 to 60% of what we offer.
Rachel Longacre is a section chief with DNR's Division of Mining, Land, and Water, and she says just over 2,000 acres were up for auction in parcels ranging in size from 20 to more than 300 acres.
Our land sales typically have been smaller for agricultural areas. This year was quite a bit larger.
All but three of the 27 parcels drew bids, and those will be offered for over-the-counter sale next month. A DNR spokesperson said 18 parcels drew multiple bids, and seven got more than 10 bids each. The 15 apparent high bidders for the land included 12 who listed an Alaska address, and they got four of the five biggest parcels. That shows the auction was a success, says Tim Schilling, a natural resource manager with the department.
We sold a lot of land. There certainly seemed to be a lot of interest.
But some Nenana area residents see it differently. Lindsay Maylard is a Nenana tribal member who grew up in the area, and she and others are worried about the impacts of what they call industrial farming.
We've just been really disappointed with the poor management and engagement with the tribal community.
Maylard works for Native Movement, an Alaska-based nonprofit that advocates for indigenous peoples. The organization was the highest bidder on two parcels, and Maylard says members intend to develop them in a way that protects the land from erosion and preserves it for traditional uses like hunting and trapping.
I'm excited and happy about that because that means that we can ensure that it's going to be managed with indigenous stewardship.
She and other area residents say the state's plan to develop the project won't create food security, as state officials insist, but instead will harm the land.
The state has not been taking the time to really listen to the concerns that the community has and that the tribe has.
We have addressed anyone who has reached out to us in an official capacity.
Longacre says the state has complied with all the required public notices and scoping meetings in the lead-up to the auction and has communicated with area residents since it began last summer. The new landowners must have an approved conservation plan completed by the spring before they can begin working the land. And State Agriculture Division Natural Resources Specialist Eric Johnson says livestock could be brought in as early as next summer.
If they have animals, they might possibly put them out as soon as they have fencing.
Johnson says goats or reindeer could take to the land quickly because they browse on natural vegetation like shrubs. He says farming is likely to begin after the land is cleared and planted next summer.
I think that they can start getting crops in the ground, you know, the second year. So September of 2024 is likely when they would be harvesting those, you know, row crops.
DNR officials say that's about when they hope to conduct the second ag project land auction. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
A $500,000 federal grant will help the University of Alaska Museum of the North preserve Bus 142. Angela Lynn, a museum collections manager, says the award from the National Park Service and the Institute of Museum and Library Services will enable preservation of the 1940s-era Fairbanks public transit bus popularized by the movie and book Into the Wild.
Freeze it and document it in its current state because, you know, the most famous part of it is from 1992 when Chris McCandless was there.
Lynn says the first step is to stabilize the bus's structure.
Making it safe for people to walk around in it, for us to move the bus to the exhibit site. But it's also about preserving the surface of the bus, both inside and outside, so that we can preserve all that graffiti and all the epitaphs that have been placed on the surface of the bus.
Although the project is focused on preserving the bus as is, Lynn notes that because it will eventually go on display outside, missing and broken windows will be replaced. The plan calls for exhibiting the bus behind the museum on the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus in a fenced area protected by a shelter.
So that the direct sun and the snow and the rain and the heavy-duty element exposure will be a little bit lessened.
Lynn says another grant is being applied for to build the bus shelter. The museum is also working with the nonprofit group Friends of Bus 142 to raise money. Lynn says the museum hopes to open the bus exhibit in 2024, but in the meantime, the public can view the bus as it's being worked on inside UAF's Usabelli building, as well as via webcam. Koyana is the Yupik word for thank you, but it takes on a whole new meaning during the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention. During the convention's Koyana Alaska performances, hundreds of people gather to watch Native dance groups from across the state perform the songs of their communities. What made this year extra special, it's the first time the dancers have performed since 2019, after back-to-back cancellations due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early has more on the first Koyana in 3 years.
The Alaska Native Heritage Dancers took the stage at Anchorage's Dena'ina Center first. The group is made up of dancers from across the state, many of them Heritage Center interns performing for a packed crowd for the first time. Anticipation was high for the return to in-person Koyana after two AFN conventions in a row went virtual due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Attendees stood in line for hours Thursday morning to get tickets, which sold out quickly. They packed a third-floor auditorium later that night. As the Heritage Dancers waved fans to the fierce pounding of drums, the crowd couldn't help but gather to the front row to watch, sometimes joining in on one of the invitational dances. On the floor below, Tariq Oviuk was lacing up his mukluk boots in preparation for his group to perform. Oviuk is from the Inupiaq village of Point Hope, about 150 miles northwest of Kotzebue. He's been coming to Koyana dances as part of the Tikiguk dancers since he was a kid.
94 was the first time I think I got to get on the plane with the dance group. And then we did a couple other ones during my high school, so That's three. Then after that, I became the dance group leader in 2001.
He says he's performed at Koyana about a dozen times. At his count, there are more than 120 dances his village has passed down over generations.
All the dances that we do are all from Point Hope, and we might have a couple that are from Little Diomede area that have been traded and agreed upon by elders long ago before me. Kind of a thing out of respect they do that.
Oviak says the dances represent many different stories, including family dances passed down, dances for ending the new year, and celebrating the full moon. He says a hard part of the last 2 years has been reckoning with the loss of loved ones in the community. One of the dances the Tikigak dancers performed was in tribute to a dance group member who passed away recently. It was performed by his wife and siblings.
We've had a lot of lost loved ones in our communities, you know. And if I could sum it all up, I can tell you right here as a walking example, this is how much I missed it. I paid my best friend's fare over here from Nome, Alaska, to come here and perform with us.
While some dancers are old hands at performing at Koyana, for many, it was their first time. Elizabeth Tugatuk is from Tuksuk Bay and has been part of the Trifornik-based Yupik dance group Achilkuk for about 5 years.
I've never done a big performance. It's my first time.
Tugatuk and her fellow dancers were sweating after their performance, lining up at a water cooler and immediately changing out of their heavy performance regalia. While Tugatuk was nervous ahead of the performance, she says it was all worth it.
To be up there to, you know, enjoy our heritage up there on the stage and share it with everyone, with our ancestors around us, it was amazing.
Excitement remained high among all the groups, including the Kikiktugwerk Northern Lights dancers from Kotzebue. Martin Lee Woods is one of the leaders of the group. He's performed at Koyana off and on most years since the first AFN in 1979. He says coming to AFN and seeing friends from across the state adds to the joy of his dance performance.
For a native to attend gatherings and to sing and dance and tell stories and feast and play games, it's a way to lift your spirit. Long, dark months up here above the Arctic Circle.
Wood says it's not just a delight for the performers. After a rough couple years, he says dancing can bring a catharsis to audience members to help them endure and remain resilient.
We grieve, we struggle, but lift your spirit and go home smiling and ready to go back to work and tackle the world. You know, this is what it's all about.
Performers graced the Koyana stage until 11 p.m. last night with another slate of groups and crowd preparing to dance all night tonight. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Chris Clint, Kavitha George, Emily Schwing, and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking 45 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com. If you are experiencing domestic violence or feel unsafe, Strong Hearts Native Helpline is here for you. Call 1-844-762-8483 or visit strongheartshelpline.org. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.